really sick of the summer of 2011, as I am. Flood, drought, famine, political breakdown, cultural breakdown, economic breakdown. I'm enough of a movie fan that the famous speech from Howard Beale, the newscaster turned prophet from the Film Network, keeps going through my head. I don't have to tell you things are bad, he begins. Everyone knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work. We're losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. And there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We all know things are bad. Worse than that, they're crazy. Well, I don't have to tell you things are bad. The streets of Damascus and Tripoli are littered with bodies. The streets of Oslo and Tokyo are flooded with tears. The streets of London and Birmingham are burning with rage. The streets of New York and Washington and Philadelphia overcome with fear and panic. Are you as sick of the summer of 2011 as I am? We all know things are bad. And yet, somehow, the image that will haunt my lament for this summer is not the image of riots in the streets or gridlock in the corridors of power. No, it's the image of the U.S. space shuttle making its final descent. Admittedly, I'm the target demographic. With at least one, if not more, model kit space shuttles still in attic storage, legacies of a childhood fascinated by the galaxy at my doorstep. But with the shuttle grounded for the last time, as our nation now tries to outsource its starbound hopes to private enterprise or foreign governments, really anybody who can afford to have these dreams on our behalf. With the symbol of what we once longed to be now a matter for a museum exhibition, a relic of something gone by, with things this bad, how are we to conclude anything but that the aspirations of our time are bound for that same dusty attic, behind some antique luggage, underneath an old sheet somebody put there in case the roof leaked, a single forgotten cardboard box labeled what might have been? Did we give up our dreams? Did they give up on us? Israel knows that attic well enough. During the exile, that attic is where Jerusalem lived, the fallen city alive only in the imagination and the memory of exiles, the far-off home that used to be, that might have been, the city of David, the city of God, the city of God's house, the place we used to live before our dreams died. You see, in Babylon, there just wasn't room for dreaming. You had to downsize. They went in the attic behind the luggage. You know the spot. But in our text today, something is radically different. The dark night of exile has passed. Ezra is leading the remnant in Jerusalem, and then far away in the Persian capital, a Jewish government official named Nehemiah, a representative to the Persian court, he hears this news. The Jerusalem walls have been destroyed. As if exile hadn't been bad enough. Now you will think of the walls first and foremost as a symbol of security, and you wouldn't be wrong, but this isn't just a matter of defense spending. Take a few facts into consideration. Jerusalem is in the mountain range of central Israel, so city walls would be the first thing that weary exiles saw on their way home. The only glimpse of the city for miles of wilderness. In Jericho, Rahab made her home in the city walls. So this isn't just protection, it's part of the fabric of the people. And as if to prove the point, much, much later, on the Isle of Patmos, John the Revelator sees a new heavenly Jerusalem populated by saints and surrounded by walls of intricate design and detail. You tell me, what heavenly city needs walls for defense? And yet, how could Jerusalem the city herself, her people, her dreams, her hopes, that the walls have fallen. Well, I don't have to tell you, things are bad. Of course, in the summer of 2011, we land quickly in the problem Cindy described last week, the problem of locating ourselves in this text. That Israel even has the opportunity to return to Jerusalem, that they even have political voice of the sort that Nehemiah represents, suggests that in some very important ways, things for Israel are better than they were. And yet for us today, so many of the voices we hear would suggest that our exile is yet to come. It has been 28 years since Ronald Reagan famously declared it to be morning in America, and whether or not you agreed with him the first time around, it is nothing short of politically fashionable in this day and age to declare us to be in a sort of imminent decline. Mourning for Nehemiah's Jerusalem, perhaps, but not here. And if you don't believe me, go home and Google Twilight in America, Evening in America, Midnight in America. Just let the vitriol wash over you. One of the rhetorical battlegrounds in the political warfare of our time is over the position of the hands on this metaphorical clock. What hour does the bell toll, and for whom? Is it too late to rebuild? If the walls of our city have been destroyed, what are we to do now with these boxed-up dreams? For Nehemiah, the answer is this, and it depends a little bit on your perspective. It's either an act of responsible government service, or blatant pork-barrel politics, or, I just like to think, radical hopefulness. Nehemiah lobbies the king for the chance to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls, and our text today is prologue to this act, the prayer of a man about to ask the government for money, the prayer of a man who knows full well wherein his dreams and the dreams of his people lie. O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you, bidding light for your servants, the people of Israel, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both I and my family have sinned. I mean no insult to Nehemiah when I say that a lot of this prayer sounds pretty generic. It's kind of the greatest hits piece of classical Torah theology. I picture one of those commercials for Time Life compilations where they scroll the song titles and then play you the samples. It's like, ooh, they've got the one about covenant and fidelity. They're right about keeping commandments. Even that bit about praying day and night is not all my favorites. Until this one remarkable moment where he puts himself on the line. Both I and my family have sinned. It's commonplace in Jewish liturgy to speak of the collective nation as a single entity, the people of Israel, the sins of the people of Israel, and so many of the prayers we have been refined and shaped into prayers for collective use. So it's something altogether different to have this striking moment of individuality. Both I and my family have sinned. Or if I said it this way, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our debts, especially mine. I have ignored my neighbor. It kind of jumps off the page. And there's no reason to think he's referring to something particularly egregious. This is the first time we've met Nehemiah. We know nothing about him. We have no reason to single him or his family out. He's not the Zodiac Killer. He didn't invent the credit default swap. He's just a guy. Both I and my family have sinned. I have to admit that I find Nehemiah's personal aside entirely refreshing. I am sure many of you will have read Warren Buffett's Times editorial from last week in which he urges economic policymakers in his language to stop coddling the super rich. And now I'm not an economic policymaker, and there's at least one really good reason for that. But in a cultural landscape obsessed with figuring out what we have to do and where is this. It begins with me. It begins with you. It begins with each of us in confession. The things we each have broken. The good we each have left undone. Of course, starting with the individual is the only option available to a nation in exile. A nation scattered from Jerusalem. Nehemiah is in a distant capital. He's not even with the people he names in the prayer. And that's precisely the point, as Nehemiah reminds God of God's promises. For your outcasts are under the farthest skies, God's words and quotes. I will gather them from there and bring them to the place at which I have chosen to establish my name. That's the dream, right? A nation rebuilt, a temple rebuilt, the hopes of a people rebuilt, the gathering together of all that has been scattered, set to the wind, torn apart. And so, even as it begins with me, this isn't old-fashioned American individualism. This isn't Nehemiah just looking out for his own interests and figuring that what was good for the one would be good for the many. Frankly, Nehemiah is a high-ranking government official. He's probably living a life of relative ease. He's got a good thing going. And if this were America, Nehemiah would be exalted as a sign that there was nothing broken there to be fixed. But for Israel in exile, the dream of Jerusalem is a collective dream. It's a dream that binds Nehemiah even to those scattered far from his sight. It's a dream that says that which is broken can be rebuilt. Those who are scattered will be together again. It begins with me, but it's about all of us. In our gospel text today, one could weep as Caiaphas almost gets the point. Jesus is on the loose, and the religious leaders of Roman-occupied Israel are worried that the imperial authorities will punish the whole nation for the revolutionary teachings of this one man. Caiaphas, the high priest at the time, is so close it hurts. You know nothing at all, he says. You do not understand that it is better for you to have one man die than to have the whole nation destroyed. Do you hear it? Yeah, that preacher is right. It is time for Warren Buffett to take personal responsibility. But of course, Caiaphas is closer than he'll ever know. A clandestine prophet of things to come. John loves the irony that quite unbeknownst to Caiaphas, Jesus will in fact die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but to gather into one, to disperse to children. Caiaphas is Israel, the exile is long over. But the dream, Nehemiah's dream, the dream of God's people continues. The dream to one day overcome the brokenness of the world. The dream of God gathering up the pieces of what might have been. And in the summer of 2011, that dream lives still, that God will gather up our sorrow, that God will gather up our fear, that God will gather up our despair. But what Caiaphas doesn't know is that he is the prophet of foregone conclusion. On his unwitting lips is the true paradox of the Christian faith, that we dream to rebuild a world that God has already overcome. And in this broken time of in-between, we are not long to make our confession. Yes, it starts with me. But here also is our assurance that this dream ends where it truly always began. All of us gathered around the cross to watch a man die in the afternoon. All of us gathered around an empty grave to watch God overturn the world by the first light of dawn. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Scattering and exile are the buzzwords of the day. This congregation has been no exception. I have the privilege of preaching on the only Sunday that this August in which you will not say some kind of institutional farewell. To Jody and myself, and of course to Mark. The God who sends us from our places of comfort, the God who scatters us into the world like seed upon the land, this is the same God who gathers us in the first place, who gathers us in the last place, who gathers us in every place where he sets his name. And so this moment is the best chance I have to offer my sincere thanks for the ways in which you all transformed the place to which I was sent into the place wherein I was called. And on the cusp of departure, it is my confident hope that says, God will gather us together again. In fact, it is our Christian faith that says, God is not yet done gathering us together. God is not done with the brokenness of this world, not in London, not in Damascus, not in Tripoli, not in Philadelphia. Though the streets of the city weep tears of sorrow, though the nation tear itself in two, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, I don't have to tell you things are bad. But I have to tell you this. Christians live in between the brokenness of this world